Well, I suppose, you know, can they prioritize uses? You know, you hear about, you know, the Israelis using water for their swimming pools while Palestinians are limited to maybe a gallon a day or something like that. And then I read recently, I saw a brochure for a golf course someplace, I think in Tiberias or somewhere, you know, this lush golf course. And
you raise a very important point. Now, you know, Per, I should take a moment here also just to say a word or two about my background so your listeners will get a sense of where I'm coming from. It's impossible to talk about anything in the Middle East without addressing politics. And so, you know, I should mention I have two passports. I have both an Israeli and an American passport. And I should also mention that I was employed by the Israeli government while I was a PhD student back in 1990, from 1998 to the year 2000. That was during the last left-leaning government that Israel had.
Those
were sort of back in the golden age of hope. You know, that was really the closest that the Israelis and the Palestinians have come to a regional accommodation. You remember the Camp David talks were happening around there, and then a set of follow-up talks in Taba. But people should realize that, you know, that I'm an Israeli Jew, and my opinions are going to be informed, and you know, with that background. I should also mention that, you know, of course, I like many progressive Israeli Jews, feels great dissatisfaction with political developments, and we certainly continue to be quite critical of the actions of the Israeli government over the last few years.
So, well,
I felt the need just to give you a copy.
Yeah. Well, there's a wide spectrum of opinion among Israeli Jews, more than there is in this country, I believe.
I think, you know, it surprises people that there's a lot more diversity of opinion within the Israeli Knesset than there is in the U.S. Congress on how to approach, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian question. And I'm glad just so you've kind of hinted at that, Per. But okay, so with that said, people often talk about swimming pools in Israeli settlements next door to Palestinian villages in which there's no piped water, in which women are having to walk long distances to springs or to wells and carry water in heavy 50, 60 pound containers on their head. And that's a reality, but it's really more of a symbolic issue than anything else. It turns out that actually swimming pools don't consume a whole lot of water. What consumes a lot of water is agriculture, and it's irrigated agriculture, and it's the ability of Israeli settlements to extract groundwater for irrigated agriculture, while Palestinians are really limited in their ability to extract water for irrigation. That's the main sort of inequity that's occurring in the West Bank. You know, let me just mention quickly, the situation in Gaza, of course, is you know, borders on borders on the kinds of conditions that you see in much of the really water stressed parts of sub-Saharan Africa.
Uh-huh.
But given not only water supply conditions, but also the current state of water and wastewater conveyance and treatment infrastructure, and that's a result of the ongoing violence, the recent Israeli you can call it a reoccupation that occurred, Gaza really is in need of large scale sort of emergency response in all its public services, but particularly in the water and wastewater sector. Now Gaza has the advantage over the West Bank of having a seacoast, and if you have a seacoast, then you potentially have no limit on the amount of fresh water that's available to you, because we've now got desalination technology whose costs have been rapidly declining.
Mm-hmm.
And which enable basically a removal of the upper limit on your potentially available freshwater resources.
What do they do with all the salt from desalinator? Where does that go? Can they do anything with it, or is it just waste?
It's conveyed back into the ocean as waste brine. There are some ecological concerns with desal. But in my opinion, and again, you know, I have a sensitivity to those questions. The benefits, the human benefits that are enjoyed by expanding freshwater access through desalination are far outweigh the ecological costs. I mean, there is one other ecological cost, which is when you have a large water intake, there can be a danger of actually pulling in a lot of local sea life, and so you can take mm-hmm. measures to minimize that problem.
Right.
But, you know, the issue in Gaza is just investment and the financial resources required to establish, to build and operate a desalination facility. But again, you know, when all kinds of basic public services are in complete disrepair, you know, I've been completely destroyed in some cases, then mm-hmm. you know, that becomes a real limitation. I was hearing reports today about negotiations between Fatah and Hamas. Mm-hmm. Those are essential, to unlock all the aid money that's now sitting sequestered right now that the West is ready to provide when they feel that the Palestinian side is able to absorb it. That is a potential benefit that's enjoyed by Gaza if we can address the political side first. But go ahead, Per.
Well, a listener called in and asked about slant drilling. Now, is that a problem with water in that area?
So a big problem in Gaza and throughout the Israeli coast is actually seawater is seawater intrusion into the subsurface.
Uh-huh.
So when you extract large volumes of water mm-hmm. along the coast, then you're reducing the hydrostatic pressure that's basically preventing saline groundwater from entering into the freshwater system along the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been an enormous problem. In fact, much groundwater in Palestine is noticeably salty. Now, remember, water can be salty enough to be harmful to consume over the long term, even when you can't taste those levels of salt. But
mm-hmm.
that's a major issue in Gaza.
Was that area always as dry as it is now? I mean, I've read that at one time, you know, the cedars of Lebanon, they were everywhere. Now there are hardly any left. And it's like, it used to be a very fertile area one time.
Yeah, you know, it's always it's a dry part of the world. It's an arid, a semi-arid area. I mean, they generally say that if you receive under 200 millimeters per year of rainfall, that you can't even grow wheat. You can't grow wheat without irrigation. And
mm-hmm.
if you look at that line, that average 200 millimeter rainfall line, it falls, kind of runs right through the southern portion of the West Bank, and then across to the west towards the Sinai Peninsula. I mean, it's a dry area.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, interestingly, there's been some research published in the last couple of years suggesting that that all the irrigation that the Israelis have been doing along the coast, in particular on the southern coast, has actually slightly increased rainfall through evaporative cooling over these large fields, but this is a very dry area, and the future to sustaining human populations there, I think, is going to be twofold. One is it's going to be the ability of our technological innovation to extract seawater resources and utilize them for human purposes. But the second is going to be resolving these political conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Not too many people are aware of this, but when Ariel Sharon, who's not generally thought of as someone who was a proponent of coexistence over the course of his career, and arguably responsible for the massacre and Sabra and Shatila in Beirut,
mm-hmm, right.
During the Lebanon War. Not too many people are aware that in 1998 he gave a speech to a conference of European foreign ministers promoting the idea of a regional water desalination facility that would supply not only Israel but also Palestine, Jordan, potentially Egypt, and this would be a really big facility. He was going to raise a lot of money from the Europe to build it. And you know, it was during a very different time. There are real synergistic gains when you're able to cooperate. And that's not pie in the sky thinking. I mean, it's been proven analytically and by economists, by water managers and engineers. You can really grow the pie if you're willing to work together.
Well, so. I've got an article here. This is from the year 2000, May 2004, from the New Scientist. And yep. It talks about Israel at that time. They called it a secret plan for a giant desalinization plant. And it would be at Caesarea. And apparently what it would do, according to the article, that it would pipe water from there to... the West Bank, and this would allow Israel to take more water from the aquifers that are under the West Bank.
I've not seen that story. The Israelis have gone ahead and built a very large, in fact, the world's largest reverse osmosis seawater desalination facility.
Mm-hmm.
Was built along the southern Israeli coast.
Mm-hmm.
Produces about 100 million cubic meters per year. And there are plans to build another facility in Hadera on the central coast. In fact, construction's already underway. Now, you know, I see things a little differently with desal. If the Israelis are able to desalinate the seawater of the Mediterranean, then you know that really does grow the size of the pie.
But are those waters equivalent, though? Are those waters equivalent in quality?
If you're treating seawater, you're going to get water of equivalent quality to water that you're pulling out of the aquifers of the West Bank.
Uh-huh.
There's not a qualitative, you know, and you got to remember there's a lot of expense associated with pumping water from, you know, the Sea of Galilee is 200 meters below sea level,
mm-hmm.
and most of the Israeli population along the coast is at sea level. So, you know, making water flow up, flow backwards, consumes a lot of energy and a lot of cost.
Well, that's what this article says, that for it to pump water from the sea up to areas in the West Bank, it's a rise of about 1,000.
That's right.
1,000 meters, so that's 3,000 feet, and it would cost around $1 per cubic meter.
Yeah, well, so you know, the desal costs right now for seawater they're quoting numbers around half that, around 50 cents per cubic meter. But realize 50 cents per cubic meter is even $1 a cubic meter is trivial. Palestinian consumers at high elevation areas when their piped water connections go dry during the summer months are paying probably 100 times that. For water that's delivered to them by tankers, whose water quality can't be assured.
Mm-hmm.
I think desal really does open up the opportunities for negotiated settlement. The Israelis could be much more efficient for the Israelis to be using water where it's located along the coasts than to be pumping it uphill and then gravity feeding it down into the coastal plain.
Well, it would mean that they are not, they wouldn't think they need, you know, it's been said that the Israeli settlements all throughout the West Bank seem to be on areas where they can tap into the groundwater.
Yeah, the settlements certainly, I mean, not only to these water questions, but on every element of the negotiations between Israel and Palestine, the settlements are an enormous obstacle. I'd be the last person to suggest that you can separate the water resource question from the settlement question. I think there's no question that without addressing those questions, it's difficult to handle any of the others.
You know, in a way, it's like, you can't separate the water between Israel and Palestine. In the same way, it's getting so with all the settlements, you really can't separate the populated areas. I mean, everything seems to point towards a sort of a single state solution or a regional solution where, you know, the water is shared in an equitable way, and everything else is shared in an equitable way. But
I'm glad to hear you say that, Per. You know, I'm not going to speak to sort of the political consolidation and the binational states that some, you know, some people tend to talk about. I will say this: the notion of the concept of Israeli water and Palestinian water, or Jordanian water, when that water is a transboundary resource. So when you have a river that crosses a boundary, or you have an aquifer that crosses a boundary,
right.
The idea that it's Israeli water, that it belongs to one side or the other, is not a hydrological concept.
Mm-hmm.
It's a value driven political concept. There's no legal framework for the apportionment of transboundary rivers and aquifers that's at all useful in resolving conflict. So the United Nations passed a convention on the non-navigational uses of transboundary river systems, and it's a mess. It's been ratified. It provides a whole series of criteria by which two parties should seek to resolve their conflicts, but there's no kind of there are many different criteria. Many of them are in conflict, and there's no guidance as to how you rank the criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just give you an example of what this translates into in practice.
Well, we're getting near the end of our time, but go ahead.
Okay, but I'll do it very quickly.
Okay.
On the West Bank, the Palestinians claim the water under the West Bank to be theirs because that's water that's rain that fell over the West Bank and recharged an aquifer. But that water tends naturally to flow from east to west towards Israel. So the Israelis claim, well, that water would naturally flow towards us, so it's our water. But the Palestinians say, no, it fell over Palestine. It's Palestinian water. When you take that argument to the waters of the Upper Jordan River, the sides exchange their arguments. The Israelis say, well, the waters of the Upper Jordan fell over Israel and recharged the river that way, so it's Israeli water. And the Palestinians say, well, no, that water would naturally flow to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the two parties will flip their argument. So, you know, the idea of a unitary watershed or water resource management approach is a beautiful one, Per.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Jeff Albert, who is a water resources specialist at the Aquia Institute in San Francisco. He will be speaking Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. That's Sunday at Congregation Shir Tikva, and the address is 621 Northeast 76. This is free to the public. Also speaking will be Congressman Earl Blumenauer and that other person you mentioned.
Musa Diabat.
Okay, you have three people will be speaking on the water situation in the Middle East. And Jeff, do you have a website where people can get more information?
I would direct people to the group that's sponsoring the talk. That's Brit Tzedek VeShalom.
Right. Okay.
It's B as in boy, V as in Victor, mm-hmm. V as in Tom, shalom.org.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per. Have a good one now.
And stay tuned for Boneheads and Bigots.
Friday, March 6th, Headlock Music, Rough Cuts Clothing, and KBOO Community Radio welcome the fireman Anthony B. to Portland, live and direct, straight out of Jamaica, for a night of conscious roots and dancehall reggae. Doors at 8, show starts at 9, with Don Dignitaries, J. Ross Pirelli, and the Escort Service Band. Small Axe Sound with YT and MC Jaga are in the house as well. All this at Barbati's downtown at Southwest 3rd and Ankeny. A portion of the proceeds of this 21 and over event will benefit KBOO Community Radio. Yes, Anthony B. So while they fight with the music up in London, we know.